Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing Western government support for authoritarian regimes in Africa. I'll be specifically looking at Chad. I'm happy to welcome back our returning guest, Dr. Nathaniel Powell, Africa analyst at Oxford Analytica. Nathaniel, it's a pleasure to have you come back again. Last time we did talk about the political unrest in Chad leading up to the elections, the elections, quote and unquote. Today we are still talking about Chad, but more broadly looking at the transformation or what has happened since last year May, you know, till now. I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Brilliant. So let's start from the election. So Chad had an election in March, supposedly an election. Since then, a lot has happened. So let's start from the election, as you predicted, you know, or as everyone with a common sense.
I don't think it was much of a prediction. It was more
of an absolute. As everyone with a common sense would see, you know, Mohamed Idris swept the election, won the election. What do you? We know there was a lot going on before the election, with the clampdown on the protests, the controversy surrounding opposition, and you know all of that. But do you think unified? How am I going to put this question in a way? I think what I'm trying to say, what happened after the election? Did the election legitimize Mohamed Idris as he wished? Did it legitimize him?
Well, at one level, it sort of does, right? I mean, it's, even though France, the United States, and other Western powers, you know, they understood that this election wasn't exactly the most freest or the fairest or the most transparent. You know, they did accept it, right? They see Mohamed Idriss Déby as the legitimate president of Chad. They, you know, relate to him as such. They don't accept any opposition claims that, in fact, Success Mazra won the election. And, you know, it's very possible that in real terms, to the extent that votes were counted, you know, he may have actually won the election, which doesn't necessarily say he's the most popular person in the country. But domestically, yeah, it doesn't change his position regarding his political legitimacy. I mean, it's throughout most of southern Chad, it's completely rejected. Parts of northern Chad, he's not particularly liked either. He does have strong kind of areas of support, though, so it's not as if he's seen everywhere as illegitimate. But I think broadly speaking, this is somebody who has to use violence and the threat of violence and intimidation in order to maintain his position at the head of the country.
Speaking of violence and the threat of violence, in I think it was this year, it's a couple of maybe some days, even a weeks ago, he faced one of the first threats to the attack on the presidential.
Early January.
Yeah, so is that from the part of the domestic people that do not accept is that the attempt to Is that a response to his perceived illegitimacy?
Well, it's a good question. There's a lot of murkiness around what actually happened. And the government claims that this was essentially a group. So what happened was there was a group of armed men. Whether or not they had firearms or not is another question. The government claims they didn't, that they just were armed with kind of knives and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they assaulted the presidential palace. They assaulted some guards outside the presidential palace, killed two or three of them, wounded some others, managed to break into the presidential palace before they ended up being mostly killed. I think 18 of them were killed, and then another six or so were captured. We haven't heard about what's happened to the captured individual since then. But let's say, ear witnesses, people in the area heard very heavy gunfire for about an hour and a half or so, which suggests that, including perhaps use of heavy weapons, would suggest that maybe these attackers actually were much better armed than the government claims. The government also claims these were drunkards or they were on drugs, and they were coming from certain quarters, certain neighborhoods of Jamina. And the implication of this that was expressed by Kulamala, who's the foreign minister, also the government spokesperson, is that these were southerners who were who resented the government. The Chad just had legislative elections in December, and in which the northern deputies backing Mohamed Deby overwhelmingly won, as expected. So this was seen as a reaction. Perhaps these people were linked to southern opposition parties, and that Deby then claimed this was actually an assassination attempt. And he was evacuated from his presidential palace. And so this is a way in some respects to point a finger at parts of the civilian opposition to say, you know, these guys are actually dangerous insurrectionaries and, or is that even a word? Dangerous rebels that are, you know, that actually change regime, you know, through force. And that could be a pretext for later waves of repression. It's not the first time they've accused the civilian opposition of trying to overthrow the government through force. So generally these accusations tend not to be based in any kind of you know, real substance. But there are other rumors to say these attackers were actually Arabic speaking, which suggests they were not actually Southerners. Most people in Chad are not Arabs. So Arabic speakers would come from parts of Central Chad, Eastern Chad, some parts of Northern Chad. So if that was the case, then these would not actually be, you know, perhaps Southern opposition, linked to Southern opposition parties, but perhaps something else. But really, there's so much murkiness around this sort of thing, and there's so many conflicting rumors that it is really hard to, you know, figure out what actually happened, except that the presidential palace was attacked by armed men, you know, which raises questions about, you know, whether it was a coup attempt. Not a serious one, I don't think, but, you know, it does... a lot more questions than answers, and frankly, I don't have any real answers. So,
Okay, let me probe you more on that. So, as you rightly observe, it's a group of drunken people could not have infiltrated or the presidential palace. So they definitely, and for that amount of time they were engaged in you know, in the gun fight, it shows that they would definitely be sophisticated and experienced. But now we could also say that Mohamed Idris has a lot of enemies. So we could put, you know, the rebels, you know, at the border of Libya, we could put oppositions, leaders from the Sultan. We could also put, could also be a case where we've seen recent rifts between Chad and France, and with the French troop leaving. Could also be a question where it could be a way to say, you know, it could be externally planned or externally. Have you heard anything like that, or what do you think?
Well, certainly the government's trying to not in a very open way, but also trying to cultivate that sort of way of thinking. They try to say, well, actually, you know, this may have actually been a result of our ejection of the French army on November 28th, and that, you know, maybe there's some hidden hand behind it. That doesn't sound very credible. If the French wanted to overthrow Mohamed Idris Deby, they wouldn't rely on, you know, a couple guys in to attack the presidential palace like that. I mean, there's, and it would be probably hard to organize anyway. The regime itself is actually very heavily defended. You have a presidential guard, which is armed to the teeth, and you have a parallel security apparatus, which is meant to counterbalance the presidential guard, called the Rapid Intervention Force, which is also very heavily armed. It's not a couple of commandos are not likely to overthrow the government, overthrow Deby. I mean, it would take something really extraordinary for that to happen. And if they did, that doesn't mean the regime necessarily changes. As we know from when his father was killed in combat, you know, the regime, Mohamed Deby's arrival in power was essentially a self-coup of the regime to make sure that it would not be replaced. The same sort of institutions and people were in power. The link that you might draw between the expulsion of the French and the French have not completed their withdrawal yet. They're supposed to be out of the country by the end of January. It may take a bit longer than that, but they are in the process of withdrawing. The link you could draw between the two is that it may have encouraged people to think that the regime actually is potentially fragile now that the French have essentially removed their protection. The French presence, especially their air presence, was always perceived as a regime protection measure. And French aircraft had repeatedly served to intervene on behalf of the regime on several different occasions. The most notable recent one was in 2019 when it attacked rebel convoys coming in from Libya. But even in 2021, when the FACT rebellion got close to the capital, and when Idriss Deby's Mohamed Deby's father was killed, he was the president at the time, Idriss Deby, the French provided vital intelligence information of tracking rebel movements and that sort of thing. And the reason why they didn't intervene was they weren't asked to. But had they been asked to intervene, they would have. And they made a very clear commitment after Deby was killed that they would protect the stability of the government using force if necessary. Now that's all fallen apart. And now that French commitment is no longer there, and that does raise questions about the vulnerability of the regime going forward. But at the same time, I don't think Mohamed Deby would have asked the French to leave if he didn't think that he already had measures in hand to protect himself without the French.
Speaking of the expulsion of the French, I wanted to speak on the paradox of this. What is the motivation? Because we could look at, like O'Reilly pointed out, French. Like last time we spoke, we did point out the irony or the hypocrisy of the French and the West in condemning Niger, and then kind of like sort of pampering Chad. They have, you know, we had some sort of but now French is the French is losing its last military base. You know, they long have a. We had another guest that also attests to the special relationship between Chad and France. So if France is expelling this, if Chad is expelling them. Well, isn't it a paradox, or what is the motivation? Let's figure out what's the motivation. Right.
So, I think there's a couple of things going on. First of all, the personal relationship between Mohamed Deby and Macron, French president, has been deteriorating the past couple of years. The French were not the French were not particularly happy with the way that he managed the transition, especially his very overt acts of violence. And the reason why the French weren't happy about that is because it undermined French credibility, right? This makes it, the French, they understand their own hypocrisy. They're not idiots, right? For them, their policy is about consistency, right? They want to protect the stability is the most important aspect of their relationship with any African country, but especially their former colonies. So ensuring regime stability and continuity and preventing a spillover of conflicts from other places into the countries that they're propping up is really key to their policy. So from their perspective in 2021, when Idriss Deby was killed, was that Idriss Deby's regime had successfully maintained stability in Chad for 30 years. And so having a sort of self-coup, bringing a son to power, had the potential of ensuring that stability would continue. And therefore they were absolutely willing to support that. Plus there was some embarrassment that they hadn't actually managed to protect Deby from being killed. And there's also the sense that, you know, this was at a moment when, relations had not yet gone sour with other Sahelian states, but they soon would. And, you know, there was a sense that, you know, Chad is kind of the last one standing. We really need to maintain our relations with Chad to prevent, ourselves from being entirely humiliated. That would come later, but, there's also a French judicial investigation into Deby's what the French call ill-gotten gains. So his use of embezzled funds to purchase lots of clothing on shopping trips and real estate and that sort of thing in Paris. So the French judiciary, you know, is independent, right? So they can do these sorts of things. But Debbie was furious about this because he thought this was a means for the French government to put pressure on him. There's another issue of contention, a bone of contention, was French criticisms of Debbie's support for the RSF in Sudan. Debbie has been in exchange, and partly in exchange for lots of funding from the United Arab Emirates, also military assistance. But he also has his own domestic political reasons for doing this. He's been supporting the rapid support forces in Sudan, allowing Emirati equipment, especially, to pass through Chadian territory, and allowing the Emiratis to establish a hospital and other facilities along the border, but also facilitate this movement of weapons into Darfur. And the French saw this as potentially destabilizing. They thought that Debbie is making a very bad political mistake here. Because the RSF is threatening Zaghawa communities in Sudan, especially around El Fasher, and the Zaghawa on the Chadian side are one of the main regime support constituencies. Debbie on his father's side is Zaghawa. Within Debbie's own family, there's a lot of resistance to him being president. So there was a fear that by supporting the RSF, he's doing something potentially destabilizing that could result in not just a coup, but a potential civil war in Chad. So the French were starting to worry that perhaps Mohamed Debbie was not the right choice as president of Chad, and that he was potentially threatening his own the foundations of his own rule. And those kind of criticisms started to grate more and more on Debbie, who has his own reasons for supporting the RSF and his own reasons for doing what he does. And so that I think that pushed him to the edge. But then you have elections that he wants to win, even if he doesn't mind rigging them. Combined with the fact the opposition mobilizes a lot around anti-French rhetoric about French supporting an authoritarian regime. The French, the ejection of France from Mali, from Burkina Faso, from Niger, is both a product of, but also an amplifier of what is often described as anti-French sentiment in the region. You know, the sense that French policies have been destructive and supportive of kind of authoritarian regimes. And that sentiment is very strong in Chad as well. So by expelling the French in a situation in which his relationships with Paris had already deteriorated, he probably thought he wasn't losing much, but he was gaining something in some ways neutralizing opposition criticisms, maybe gaining some electoral support ahead of the December legislative elections, but also a way of gaining in his kind of reputation and regional stature within the region, among populations. And, you know, this is at a moment where this is not the 1950s or 1970s or 60s or 80s anymore, right? There are alternative geopolitical partners available. And I'm not just talking about the Russians, which are the ones that the Westerns always fear, always worry about. But we have the Emiratis, we have the Turks, we have the Iranians. I don't think Chad's going to do much with Iran at the moment. But, you also have the Chinese. A number of smaller actors. I mean, Hungary, bizarrely, has deployed a few hundred troops. Is deploying or will deploy a few hundred troops to Chad. Nobody really has figured out why they're doing that. What it illustrates is for Chad is that they have other options than the French, and options that are maybe more willing to help him in ways that he wants to be helped. Whereas the French would always impose conditions and conditionalities on their ties. So, from Debbie's perspective, he may feel that he's lost very little, but he's gained politically and domestically, and he has alternatives to the French anyway.
I've seen that. That's the right transition into the next question. I've seen where Hungary is deploying about 200 stuff into that. But then again, you touched on something very, very important. So there is no doubt that we've seen that Western powers have, in a way, either directly or indirectly propped up authoritarian government under the banner of stability, which is in my recent work I've started questioning that concept of stability. But then again, we're not seeing the anti-French sentiment and the anti-Western sentiments open up an avenue for Africans to diversify their foreign relations, and we're seeing not just the superpowers like you really mentioned, not Russia and China, we're seeing other medium powers, like you see Hungary, you see Turkey. Do you think, let me use the word of another guest that we had that was talking about the anti-French sentiment. Do you think Africa is going from the, how do they say, from the frying pan to the fire with the with these actors?
Well, you know, obviously it's very hard to say. I mean, the, you know, the West, from the Western perspective, this is a bad thing, not only because, you know, they're losing influence, but because the actors that African countries are choosing are, you know, they're not democratic. They don't have the same respect for human rights or alleged respect for human rights that Western countries mm-hmm. are meant to have. They don't attach the same kind of conditionalities on governance and that sort of thing. So, you know, and, you know, there's the one thing that you could say about those arguments that's true, although hypocritical, because the West is a similar sort of thing, is that, it, you know, these governments are willing to offer support to any kind of regime, you know, security assistance, without without you know, being too concerned about what this regime actually does with it, you know. And you know, there's, you know, I think at the end of the day, the positive aspect of this from the African perspective is that it increases just strategic autonomy of African governments, right? You can play off a number of different partners against each other. You can multiply your partnerships, which reduces the amount that any particular one can actually, you know, have leverage over you. And that, at the end of the day, from a state-to-state perspective, is, you know, a very positive thing. And it's probably a positive thing in a number of different levels as well. But it doesn't change the fundamental relationship of dependence between a state and foreign partners, right? And that relationship of dependence has consequences in terms of accountability of governments towards their own populations, on you know, measures of, you know, governability and human rights, and, you know, probably even economic development and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think there's two ways to look at your question, basically. One is that, like, you're basically replacing one set of essentially negative actors with another broader set of negative actors. And the other is you're not changing that question of dependence, which is, you know, which remains. But on the other hand, you know, yeah, you know, African countries are less, and I'm speaking very generally here, because, you know, there are always exceptions, are, you know, now less dependent on, you know, the former colonial powers than they used to be. And that is a positive thing. I think yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, yeah, go on.
I think the answer to that is ambiguity.
I can see the two sides of the coin. It's positive in a sense where it gives them some leverage and some lever to pull when it comes to having a wider pool of external actors to deal with. But like Riley said, if the goal is to have some sort of independence or some sort of, then they've defeated our purpose, because just going from one actor to another.
Right. So,
but there's something you mentioned in terms of, like, the fragility or vulnerability of the, of the, let's come out to Chad now, of the Chadian system in terms of expelling the Russian French soldiers. But even before then, let's look at on top of this recent attack in the presidential palace of Chadian, we also saw where about 40 or so Chadian soldiers were killed by Boko Haram and the rest. So despite all this heavy military presence or military, you know, in Chad, we still see all these security lapses. How do you speak to that disconnect?
I mean, I would just add that loss to Boko Haram or JAS or whatever group it was, did also played a role in the Chadian decision to expel the French, because the French apparently, this is what the Chadians say, the French haven't responded to it. The French apparently refused to provide assistance to the Chadian forces in Lake Chad area through intelligence. I think they wanted intelligence sharing, and the French weren't interested in doing that. So, you know, that's one more layer of criticism they could level against the French, that you actually aren't living up to your promise to protect us, right, to help us out. So in terms of security lapses, I mean, the Chadian military, at least this is the commonplace among analysts, and I don't see any reason to question it, is that you have sort of a two-speed army or a three-speed army, where, you know, the bulk of the army is not particularly well paid, it's not particularly well armed, the living conditions aren't particularly good. A lot of them are integrated former rebels, and you have a plethora of senior officers. I think I read somewhere this was from a couple years ago, but I'm sure it hasn't changed too much, that Chad had something like 600 generals. That's more than France. I think more than the United States. In terms of the number of general officers for a country that's you know not particularly large population wise, you know, it's 11 or 12 million. And these are patronage posts mostly, not all of them, but like these are, you get to be a general. You're a former rebel, fine. If you stop your rebellion, I'll make you a general, and you get your maybe you get your salary and a house and a driver or something. you get to notionally command. So that's this army's not the one that is fighting usually, right? Or they're sitting in garrisons, and maybe they're. Mm. But then you have the presidential guard, and I think the ones killed, and I'm not entirely sure, but I think the ones killed in the attack on the island were from the presidential guard, which does. Mm. Yeah, it raises questions as to their capabilities, but this isn't just a Chadian problem, right? I mean, you see ISWAP in Nigeria overrunning military bases in Borno, and the Nigerian army has lots of problems, but they also have a lot of strengths, and we're talking about jihadist groups that have actually gotten quite capable, right? Mm. Especially kind of hit and run raids, so it's. With lack of evidence, it's hard to know, exactly what happened in the ground. We do know that the Chadian counteroffensive, which happened after that, killed probably several dozen jihadists, maybe more, maybe over 100. Several senior-ranking officers were also killed, Chadian officers. And then there were airstrikes on Nigerian soil, which killed a number of Nigerian civilians.
Civilians, yeah.
But this is not unique to Chad. All the regional militaries tend to resort to slash and burn counterinsurgency methods, partly because it's a lack of means, right? You don't have the kind of intelligence and equipment that you can be more surgical, so you're not surgical, right? You just tend to as a community that is close to Boko Haram, so you're going to torch that community, right? Doesn't matter. You're not going to make any distinctions about who's who. Which tends to exacerbate the problem, of course. But and Chad's no different in that sense. Chad's advantage, I guess, against Boko Haram is one, the Presidential Guard, the DGSSIE, is probably more capable at a unit-to-unit level than the Cameroonian or Nigerian or Nigerian equivalents. Mm. And then the other issue is Chad is geographically somewhat protected. So you have the lake area, which is where JAS and ISWAP operate. But they haven't made any moves into the Chadian interior, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But unlike in Nigeria and Cameroon and Niger to some extent, there hasn't been any jihadist infiltration of the Chadian interior. So essentially, Chad's fighting against Boko Haram is in the lake and on lake islands and that sort of thing. Since the Boko Haram rebellion broke out, right? I mean, the Chadian government's line to its own citizens is like, look, we're protecting you. There's no Boko Haram in Chad. This is all in the lake, right? And the casualties we're suffering in the lake is to protect the rest of the country. So I'm not sure this is seen as, you lose 40 men on an island, that looks pretty bad. But, Mohammed Debi can still go to his population and say, look, A, we launched a counteroffensive. B, there's no Boko Haram in Chad. And... Mm. He has a point.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of the 600 generals, Debbie also promoted himself to field Marshal. What is the motivation for that? What is the implication of that?
Oh, Marshal. Yeah. Well, it's funny. His father also promoted himself to Marshal after a counteroffensive against Boko Haram. So, I guess it's I don't know. I mean, you do have some of these leaders that do funny things, like. In Central African Republic, right, you had a Bokassa who was a general. He promoted himself to marshal. A couple years later, he promoted himself to emperor before he was overthrown by the French. Then in the Sahelian juntas, they've, except for the leader of Burkina Faso, Ibrahim Traoré, the rest of them have all promoted themselves. They were colonels and they took power. Now they're all generals, right? And maybe Mohamed Debi just wanted to one-up them. Said, well, you're generals, but hey. I'm a marshal. I don't know what the logic is, apart from self-aggrandizement and what he thinks that brings him. Maybe it does bring him something. I'm not really in a position to tell. I know from the outside it looks silly, but there must be another logic there, and it's hard to parse that out.
Yeah, we've seen recently, this might be something a bit different, but still within the lake. We've seen where President Tinubu of Nigeria is kind of like, maybe French is cutting President Tinubu. There's this, you know, assumption that French is seeking some base in Nigeria also. And also looking at President Tinubu as well, so far as the question of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of like, is that true? Is French seeking that kind of relationship? Can Nigeria, you know, succumb to that kind of partnership? And then again, why does French always operate in a place where, where, you know, there's question of legitimacy already with this, mm-hmm. with this government?
Well, I mean, France has few potential partners in West Africa that you could call legitimate in the full sense of the word. I mean, if you're going to engage, I mean, to some extent, one argument you can make is you have to engage with these countries, you know, whether the leadership is legitimate or not. You know, like they're potential trading partners and they have populations that would, you know, that would benefit or not, or at least you would benefit, right? But from the French perspective, Nigeria has always been important in different ways. So in the 1960s, he saw it as a geopolitical rival in West Africa, right? Mm. And that accounts for like longstanding tension between Nigeria and France, particularly because of the Biafra War, right? France provided assistance to the Biafran secession. Yeah. And this is long remembered in Nigeria. And, you know, there is a degree of resentment there. But what's interesting is just a few years after that, so by the mid-1970s, Nigeria had become France's largest trading partner in Africa. In sub-Saharan Africa. So I think so apart from Egypt and I think like Libya, Nigeria was France's largest trading partner in Africa. And after that was South Africa. So, and to this day, Nigeria remains France's largest trading partner, or second. I think Egypt still might be the largest one in Africa. Then after that, it's Nigeria. And then after that, South Africa. So it's not the Francophone countries. It's not the former colonies that are France's most important economic, that have the closest economic ties to France. It's Nigeria. And that's still the case. And Macron, I think, especially in the context of being rejected from the rest of the continent, from the rest of West Africa, you know, there's Nigeria is not only a solid economic partner, but Macron has personal ties to Nigeria. Like he spent some time there, right? When he was when he was in university, and then Tinubu, right, has long preferred Paris over London. You know, unlike Buhari or some of the other, you know, Nigerian elite. He's long preferred France as a place to go for, you know, for his medical visits and, you know, his vacations. You know, so there's those ties that I think have contributed to both of them seeing this as an opportunity to try to improve relations. So you had, you know, Tinubu state visit there a couple of months ago. But so that's kind of the economic and kind of diplomatic angle. France is trying to compensate for its losses elsewhere with, you know, Nigeria. But yeah, I mean, there is, and there's no way that this would ever be made public, and I have no idea whether it's true or not, but there would be, you know, there's an advantage for France to build, say, closer intelligence ties with Nigeria, because this is, it's lost its foothold in the Sahel, and it needs other partners willing to provide, you know, access and share intelligence. So, I mean, I can see this as a potential security aspect of a security relationship. There's other aspects of a Franco-Nigerian security relationship. There's a lot of cooperation at the naval level between the French and the Nigerians. There were joint exercises, I think, that were held a couple months ago. The Nigerians also participate in French kind of counterterrorism training exercises in other parts of West Africa. So there is a security relationship. But I think I would draw the line at saying the French are trying to establish an actual base in Nigeria. I think that would be very hard to hide. And so Niger, the junta in Niger has been making these sorts of accusations. But especially, I mean, to be fair, when the coup in Niger happened, you know, Nigeria and France were both gung-ho about overthrowing the Nigerian junta, right? And you know, Tinubu, had he not faced so much domestic
resistance,
like they would have done that. They would have tried to do that anyway, right?
Yeah.
And they would have been backed by France, and France would have helped provide, you know, at least intelligence, if not other kinds of support. So that's not wrong. What I do think would be very difficult for the French to do politically, and I don't think Tinubu could handle this either, would be to establish a French base there. At least, you know, anything more than something very small and very invisible. But you wouldn't have a major French base there. I don't see that happening. They would. I mean, the U.S. was potentially interested in establishing a base there, right? With AFRICOM, and Nigerians said no, they're not going to take that. I mean, they're happy to have good economic ties, security assistance, acquisition of military hardware. But Nigeria has always been very touchy, I think, when it comes to foreign bases, and you know they're very, very sensitive about sovereignty and that sort of thing. And I don't see that changing. I don't think they're going to offer the French, that kind of a foothold. Yeah. Assuming that's what the French would even be asking for, and I'm not even sure they would be.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I agree very, very 100%. Nigeria is very sensitive about that. But you mentioned the US, and speaking of the US, I think when the French started being expelled from Niger, you know, the US felt a bit comfortable. You know, maybe they felt, oh, we didn't have this colonial history. But sooner they were also expelled. So, but in the context of Trump coming back into power and looking at what's going on in the Sahel with these, how do you think the relationship is going to play out with in the Sahel? Because the Sahel as well might also be painted as an unstable place, and also within the geopolitical competition between Russia and, do you think that the US under Trump do you think there might be some sort of action activity from the US while they're speaking to Bonus? This is from the US now.
That's a good question. So with Trump, you literally never know. So I would say, from if you look at the top level of government in the US, to the extent there is any coherence there, like even under other administrations, Africa as a whole, including the Sahel, has been a tertiary strategic interest, right? They're just not that interested. It wanes and waxes. It ebbs and flows depending on the administration, depending on what's actually, you know, depending on the geopolitical context. But, you know, recent years, the main U.S. interest has been countering Russia and China, a bit like the Cold War. And I think that's probably not going to change under Trump, right? The question is, what kind of prioritization is he going to place Africa in that broader, you know, context of geopolitical competition? And the Sahel especially, right? And I don't see the Sahel being that big of a priority for the Trump administration. I could be completely wrong about this. But given the way that Trump talks about Africa and Africans, shithole countries and that sort of thing, and this new Muslim ban, which is essentially the same thing as the old one, except worse. I think we're, you know, unless he has very activist advisors trying to draw him in, then, you know, I don't think there's going to be an effort to really get massively engaged in the region. That doesn't mean you're not going to have, you know, I mean, AFRICOM's always looking for something to do. After the expulsion of Niger, they lost a lot of their raison d'etre. So they've been trying to negotiate for basing arrangements, right, in Cote d'Ivoire and Benin. In Nigeria, as I said, there was some talk about them trying to, you know, negotiate something. I think that fell apart very quickly. I think that, you know, Nigerians said, no, we're not going to do that. The U.S. had some locations, small locations in Cameroon for a while. I think those have been shut down for quite a while now. But apart from training and the flintlock exercises, I don't see much of that changing. I think we might just see this. We're in for the status quo at the moment in terms of the security level of that relationship. I mean, we're not going to see a U.S. military intervention in West Africa. That would be very strange and unprecedented. Not unprecedented in terms of military interventions, but for the region, the U.S. would be very weird if they did that. You have to have something really extraordinary happen for that to happen.
Yeah. What you said is more in concert with what previous guests have said as well. They like, unless you have some sort of like 9/11 kind of like event.
Dealing with 9/11, and it was proven this was organized by, you know, JNIM and Mali, you know, then you could see it. But JNIM's not going to do that. So.
I agree. And then again, I don't know. Like we've been saying, this could be good or bad, because again, I'm looking at Trump suspending aid, foreign aid, looking into some of these international multilateral stuff. So it might be good for Africa as well to look inwards, and you know, some of these countries are already, which sometimes I don't know if it's true. Looking at what's going to Burkina Faso with the whole talk of, I don't know if it's just, you know, just riding the wave of the anti-West, anti-polar, but it might also be a good thing. But let me come to the conclusion and say, let's look at Chad. Let's look at Chad as a case study, but also it speaks to other authorities. How do you see event happening in Chad moving forward? With the, I just wanted to give like a in conclusion, like with expulsion of the French, with the different actors that have been caught in with the resistance opposition. How do you see Debbie riding all of these threats and maybe opportunities that come with it as well? How do you, you know, in conclusion?
I have no idea. I think
I like that.
There's two readings of Debbie, and I don't know which one's correct. So one is that his and you see this especially in Western security circles, that he's not a particularly adept political politician, that he's alienated lots of people he shouldn't have alienated, and that because of this, there's an ever-present coup threat that will one day or the other materialize, and he will be overthrown. And the consequences of this could be disastrous, partly because of his management of his own family, his management of his father's, and partly to some extent his own ethnic constituency, his meddling in the affairs of Sudan and the Sudanese civil war, his creation of parallel security apparatuses, his alienation of parts of the opposition, his failure to effectively integrate armed groups that he promised to integrate. You know, all these look like it could be really, really bad for him. An alternative interpretation is that he's actually been very effective at doing just the right things to mollify just the right number of people to prevent something like that from happening. So yes, he's moved away from exclusive dependence on the Zagawa on a Zagawa ethnic constituency, but he's broadened it to others, and he's brought other people in, especially in the north, into the government that you know, his father's regime might not have fully kind of might have excluded more. A lot of the rebel groups, some of them were quite dangerous in the past, have been neutralized, at least for the moment. And through a combination of absolutely brutal repression and co-optation, he's effectively neutralized the civilian opposition. So, and then his creation of parallel security apparatuses might actually work effectively as a coup-proofing device to prevent anybody from trying to make that move. And I think only time will tell.
It's
a terrible thing to say for somebody in my position who has to predict things, but I have no idea. It's what is true, I think, is that, you know, the hope, any hope that people may have had during the political transition that Chad might actually, you know, develop some kind of more accountable and transparent democratic characteristics, those have all fallen by the wayside. Chad will remain a deeply authoritarian and violently repressive state, you know, at least up to a point for quite a while to come. And I think that's with always a latent possibility for renewed strife and war. Chad's seen cycles of rebellion in the past, and I don't see any reason why that won't continue in the future. And I think that's really unfortunate. And that's also partly Debbie's responsibility, but it also goes deeper than that.
Wow, it's really unfortunate, but well, you've managed, you know, to give a good prognosis of what might happen. Nathaniel, we're very grateful to have you, you know, come back again. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I'll keep you posted once this is aired in a couple of weeks. But yeah, thank you very much for this very rich insight into this conversation.
Anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in once again to this week's episode. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Nathaniel Powell, for his rich and very great insight into the authoritarian, the propping of authoritarian governments in Africa, looking at Chad. Stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.